I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the U.S. Secretary of State is in the Mideast looking to jumpstart peace talks. U.S. lawmakers pledge to back Israel against Iran.
For the Iranian regime, you're one of the biggest evils on the planet, and we will stand up to you. We will stand by our friends.
Syrian refugees hunt for work in Lebanon. And a look at what is behind the drop in Syrian refugees to Jordan. It's all ahead. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met separately today with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas as part of Obama administration efforts to jumpstart peace talks. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns has the story.
Netanyahu commended U.S. congressional moves to upgrade sanctions against Tehran and recommit the United States to standing with Israel against the threat of Iran's nuclear program. But above all, he said, what we want to do is to restart the peace talks with the Palestinians. Ahead of their Jerusalem meeting, Kerry said he's grateful for the seriousness with which Netanyahu is working on returning to those talks and appreciative of the personal energy he's putting into helping move forward.
I know this region well enough to know that there is skepticism. In some quarters, there is cynicism. And there are reasons for it. There have been bitter years of disappointment. It is our hope that by being methodical, careful, patient, but detailed and tenacious, that we can lay out a path ahead that could conceivably surprise people, but certainly exhaust the possibilities of peace.
Kerry met separately with Palestinian President Abbas in the West Bank, but neither man spoke with reporters ahead of those talks. Chief Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat told a United Nations committee this week that Palestinians are exerting every possible effort to see that U.S. peace efforts succeed. He added, "No one benefits more from the success of Secretary Kerry than Palestinians, and no one loses more from his failure than Palestinians." Erekat said there's a good opportunity now to get to a two-state solution to the conflict, roughly along pre-1967 boundaries. Kerry has helped revive an Arab League peace initiative on a two-state solution that includes concessions of land swaps to account for post-1967 Israeli settlements. Kerry and Netanyahu also discussed the civil war in neighboring Syria and a U.S.-Russia initiative to negotiate a transitional authority for Damascus.
Nobody has any illusions about how difficult, complicated, what a steep climb that is. But we also understand that the killing that is taking place, the massacres that are taking place, the incredible destabilization of Syria is spilling over into Lebanon, into Jordan, and has an impact, obviously, on Israel.
Israel is thought to have attacked weapons shipments inside Syria that were going to Lebanese Hezbollah militants, who've increasingly joined the fight alongside troops loyal to embattled Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. While Russia is a co-sponsor of this Syrian peace effort, it remains one of the biggest arms suppliers to the government in Damascus.
S-300 missiles coming from Russia or other countries, from Iran missiles, are destabilizing to the region. The United States is committed, not only in its defense of Israel, but in its concerns for the region, to try to address this issue.
Netanyahu also met Thursday with former French President Nicolas Sarkozy and with British Foreign Secretary William Hague. Hague was in Jordan Wednesday with Kerry and officials from 9 other countries backing Syria's opposition. That group agreed to increase its support for opposition groups if Mr. Assad does not agree to peace talks. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Ramallah, the West Bank.
As Scott referred to, the U.S. Senate has approved a resolution affirming America's firm opposition to Iran's nuclear ambitions and pledging full support for Israel in the event of an Israeli military strike against Iran's nuclear facilities. VOA's Michael Bowman has more on the story from Capitol Hill.
The yeas are 99, the nays are zero.
The chance to slam Iran's government and speak up for Israel brought a rare moment of complete bipartisan unity to the Senate. Republican Lindsey Graham was a lead sponsor of the resolution.
If that day ever comes where Israel has to take military action, to our friends in Israel, we will be there with you at every step of the way, diplomatically, economically, and yes, militarily. And to the Iranian people, we would love to have a better relationship with you to the Iranian regime, you are one of the biggest evils on the planet, and we will stand up to you. We will stand by our friends.
The resolution is an expression of the collective will of the Senate. It neither authorizes the use of U.S. military force nor constitutes a declaration of war. Democratic Senator Robert Menendez noted a new report by the International Atomic Energy Agency saying Iran has boosted its ability to enrich uranium with hundreds of new centrifuges.
We seek full implementation of U.S. and international sanctions on Iran and urging the president to continue to strengthen enforcement of those sanctions. I cannot emphasize enough my strong concerns about Iran's nuclear program and the extraordinary threat it poses, yes, to Israel, but very importantly to the United States of America.
Iran has long insisted its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes, arguing that Israel is the true threat to regional peace. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
Iran is going into elections in June. And we learned that Iran's electoral watchdog has barred moderate ex-president Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani from participating. Eight candidates won approval to stand, five conservatives close to the supreme leader, as well as two moderate conservatives and a reformist. VOA's Carol Castiel asked Veli Nasser, dean of Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, what he thinks of these recent turn of events.
Well, I think the supreme leader made a decision that Rafsanjani could be problematic for him and that there might be a chance that he will win, and therefore decided at this point in time to exclude him on a technicality of his age. But it also suggests that, you know, this has been a deliberative process on his part. He's been thinking about how to game the elections, you know, how to satisfy his conservative hardline base and yet see whether there is a way to have reformists in the mix that would then help increase the participation rate by bringing sort of people who are not conservative in Iran or are reformists to actually vote. He's also conscious that he, at the one level, he wants to bring a president who would be a kinder face to the international community and help reduce pressure on Iran. But I think the supreme leader also wants to control the next Iranian president. And Rafsanjani definitely is not a person that the supreme leader could control.
My colleague also asked our SAIS expert about the more than two-year-old bloody conflict in Syria.
Critics say that if the United States had engaged earlier and provided lethal support to the rebels or even greater leadership to U.S. allies like Turkey and other Gulf states that are supporting the rebels, that things would be different today. Do you think had the United States acted like this earlier, perhaps a year or so ago when former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and other members of the cabinet suggested that the United States get involved with lethal assistance? Or do you think that the jihadis who are infiltrating the opposition would have infiltrated anyway?
Well, they would have. The jihadis would have infiltrated anyway. But ultimately, exactly because the jihadis are going to infiltrate, it would be beneficial to us to set up a non-jihadi faction in Syria that's capable of fighting jihadis, unless we intend to go fight ourselves. So, you know, the sooner we did this, the better it would have been. There would have been an American-backed militia with American arms, American training, with American relationships that then, you know, could have been a fact on the ground against the jihadis. So we right now, you have a situation where the Syrian state is collapsing and there is no counterweight to the jihadis, so they're taking over. I think American leadership would have mattered, and it need not only have been in the military arena. I think leadership on addressing the humanitarian issue, I think leadership on the diplomatic front would have mattered. I think we could have made the Syrian opposition a more serious force than it is. We could have coordinated better around regional leaders. We could have been in much more serious conversations with Russia and China than ones that we have had. And I think generally the symbolism of our disengagement has caused the situation to become much more chaotic. I mean, the very sign of American seriousness would mean that everybody would calculate the situation differently. And, you know, ultimately Syria is in a situation that it's getting worse and worse, getting to a point where we can no longer ignore it, But by the time we begin paying attention to it, the cost of addressing it is also going to be much higher.
What's your view of the so-called international peace conference that would be brokered by the United States and Russia on Syria? Do you have any hopes for a negotiated settlement at this point?
I think a negotiated settlement is going to be difficult to get to, and it's not going to happen in one or two meetings. The question is, you know, you go into Geneva meeting, the next meeting, with the hope of creating an ongoing process that can get you maybe to a ceasefire and then show a path going forward. But I don't think, you know, the Russians or the Syrians or the Iranians are going to take the peace conference seriously unless you also change the facts on the ground on them. And that's not going to happen unless the rebels become a more serious fighting force. If Assad really calculates that he could lose the war and it's better for him to negotiate now. And I think we've started with the diplomacy without backing diplomacy with force. And that will make it, I think, more difficult.
Vali Nasser, Dean of Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies and former senior advisor to Richard Holbrooke. You can hear more of his remarks this Saturday and Sunday on VOA's Press Conference USA or listen to our podcast at voanews.com. Nearly 500,000 Syrians have fled to Lebanon because of Syria's ongoing civil war. Many of these are families living in makeshift camps. But there is also a significant number of unaccompanied young men trying to survive in Lebanon cities. Correspondent Scott Bob reports from Beirut for VOA Television.
A construction site in central Beirut. 20-year-old Mahmoud, he gives only his first name, is selling bread from a bicycle cart. He fled his home in Aleppo a year ago as the uprising against the Syrian government became increasingly violent. Most Syrian refugees stay near the border, often in makeshift housing, but some go to the cities to find work. Mahmoud makes $15 to $20 a day. He misses home.
A lot. I miss it a lot. As soon as this war is over, I will go back.
In the evening, people exercise or relax on Beirut's seaside corniche. 16-year-old Abderrahman came with his older brother. He sells flowers to help his 13 brothers and sisters back home. He makes about $15 a day, but it is hard work.
As the day begins, I sleep. I start working at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I don't go back home until 3 o'clock in the morning.
18-year-old Ali Hassan came from Idlib with his brothers, aged 10 and 11. They live with some cousins. Their families feared for their lives as the conflict worsened.
For sure, the days are hard without my family, without my mother, without my father.
Hassan would like to return home. He hopes the conflict that has torn apart so many families will end soon. Scott Bob, VOA News, Beirut.
The constant flow of refugees from Syria into Jordan has slowed to a near halt in recent days, raising concerns of yet another humanitarian crisis in the two-year conflict. VOA's Elizabeth Errett reports from the Zaatari refugee camp near the Syrian border.
The war in Syria has turned this dusty, desolate patch of land just south of the border into what is now Jordan's fifth largest city. An average of 2,500 Syrians fled here every day in the last few months. But since Sunday, according to those registering new refugees at the camp, not a single one has come. Humanitarian officials say only a handful of refugees has entered the country in the past few days. Refugee Osama was one of the last to check in here, arriving with his family Saturday. Osama says conditions in his village near the border had deteriorated rapidly as troops loyal to President Bashar al-Assad went on the offensive against rebels in the area. He says government snipers shot at anyone trying to leave. Still, he and his relatives made the difficult journey unharmed. But the next day, some charged, it was not just the Syrian government trying to stop the exodus, but Jordanian border guards as well. Jordanian authorities reject the accusation, saying they're not stopping anyone from coming in. There are several official crossings along the border and dozens of unofficial ones. Retired General Fayez al-Duari of the King Abdullah Academy for Defense Studies says Jordan will keep the borders open no matter what.
He says the reasons are many, including historic ties between the people of the two countries and the religious and moral imperative of helping anyone fleeing violence and death. Jordan has been hospitable, taking in some 500,000 Syrians, 130,000 in Zaatari and the rest mixing in with the general population and imposing a huge strain on the nation's limited resources. One security official suggests that burden may be behind the drop in numbers, which coincides with meetings on increasing aid to cope with the refugees. A few days into the crisis, the United Nations and the United States announced additional aid. The cutoff has also coincided with what rebels say is a dramatic decrease in the supply of weapons and other material support that had been flowing through Jordan from rebel allies in the Gulf, raising additional questions of behind-the-scenes deals. Although the reasons for the drop-off in refugee numbers remain unclear, one thing is certain. Thousands of refugees are trying to get to safety and cannot, adding another layer of misery onto an already miserable situation. Elizabeth Barrett, VOA News, Zaatari Refugee Camp, Jordan.
A senior European Union official is calling for more humanitarian aid in Syria. Lisa Schlein has details from Geneva.
EU Commissioner for Humanitarian Aid, Kristalina Georgieva, says there has been a rapid deterioration of the humanitarian crisis in Syria and neighboring countries since her last visit to the region in December. Speaking Wednesday on her return from the region, she says there now are more than 1.5 million refugees. She says about one-third of Syria's population of 22 million, including some 5 million internally displaced, are in need of humanitarian assistance. Georgieva says tensions are flaring in neighboring countries where refugees are concentrated and outnumbering the local populations.
The refugees are in competition for jobs, for housing. Rents have gone up 3, 4, 5 times in villages and cities where the presence of refugees is most significant. They are in competition for water. They are in competition for medical services, for schooling. Very clearly, the communities and the countries are feeling under existential threat.
Georgieva says the humanitarian operation for Syrians inside and outside the country is woefully underfunded. She says the international community must provide more money for aid. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.